Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome, welcome. It's Justin Brierley with you for the show that aims to get you thinking every week on Premier Christian Radio, available as a podcast all over the world. Unbelievable. Conversations that matter, and a really interesting one today on demons and exorcism. Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer are my guests. I'll be introducing them in a short moment's time. For more from the show, the podcast, the social media, the book, the newsletter, ways to give, and more besides, check out our show page at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Just before we leap into today's show, this past week saw the release of a full independent report on sexual misconduct by Ravi Zacharias. It is a shocking and sobering read. My thoughts are with the victims and the many others who looked up to Ravi and are feeling utterly betrayed and disillusioned by what is evidently very much a double life he was leading. Sobering lessons here for anyone involved in Christian ministry. If you'd like more on that, we do have news reports and response over at premierchristian.news. And I'm going to be sharing some of my personal response on this whole sad situation in the coming week. Just pray, Lord, have mercy in what is just an awful, awful situation for so many people. But later on in the show today, your feedback coming up on the issue of transgender and Christianity. Really interesting feedback on this. So hold on for that at the end of the show. And what an interesting discussion I have for you on today's programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
On today's show, we're asking, are demons and exorcism for real? According to some reports, demands for exorcism by priests has been on the rise in recent years. But is demonic possession and exorcism a provable spiritual reality, or does it belong in the realm of fantasy horror? Billy Hallowell is a Christian journalist and author whose recent book, Playing with Fire, is a modern investigation into demons, exorcism and ghosts. And he details multiple accounts of apparent demonic possession and how modern deliverance ministry in both the Catholic and Protestant traditions are seeking to treat the phenomenon. Michael Shermer is a well-known atheist and founder-in-chief of Skeptic magazine. He's the author of many books, including most recently, Giving the Devil His Due, Reflections of a Scientific Humanist. He believes that paranormal claims around demons and exorcism don't stand up to scrutiny and are better explained as the result of mental illness or misunderstanding or even fraud. So we'll be hearing some of the stories that Billy has uncovered and asking whether a natural or a supernatural explanation makes best sense of demons and exorcism. Billy and Michael, welcome along to the show today. Great to have you with me. Billy, we'll start with you. Your first time on the show, and it's great to have you on this fascinating topic. What made you want to write a book in this particular area?
Well, thanks for having me. And if I'm being fully honest, this was not a topic I really wanted to write on. It's something that I've been fascinated by for a long time. It's something that as a journalist, I would often encounter this when I was a faith editor. You know, stories would come in, and of course, there are all sorts of levels of believability in these stories. And, you know, over the years, it was something I sort of couldn't escape. And when this opportunity came a couple of years ago, you know, I prayed about it. I didn't feel right about it. So I actually said no. So this was a book that really should have been written a few years ago. And it came back around in the most bizarre of ways. And long story short, my publisher, you know, came back and said, hey, is this something you would want to do? And I prayed about it. I'm a Christian. That's what I do. And I felt like it was a topic worthy of discussion. I think there's a lot of subjects in the church, in Christian circles that we often don't talk enough about. And I think this is one of them. And when I say talk about it, I mean in a reasonable, rational way, trying to understand what does Scripture say and what do we see in the real world?
I said that there has been an apparent rise in the demand for exorcism, especially in the Catholic Church in recent years. What do you attribute that to?
You know, it's interesting, and I think there are probably a million things that Michael might say in opposition to this, but I do think as we've moved away, and this is what, you know, people will tell you, experts in the Catholic Church and in Protestant circles, as culture moves away from faith, you have this sort of opening, right? And this is what they will say, that this opening has sort of led us into a place where, and it's a little bizarre, right? Because you've got fewer people going to church, fewer people calling themselves Christians. In America, for instance, we're at about 65% of the population. And of course, a lot of these people are nominal, but they're calling themselves Christians. That's down from 78% just in 2007. And so we're seeing this decline in faith allegiance, this rise of the nuns, not the Catholic nuns, but the people who are atheist, agnostic, or unaffiliated. And yet at the same time, you're seeing this increase of people who are seeking spiritual help. Now, whether or not they actually have spiritual issues or there are mental issues going on, there seems to be a real influx, and we're seeing that across the board being described by almost every expert I've interacted with, to the point where, by the way, this is not something that you often hear the Catholic Church speaking out about. And I would add one other thing that I find fascinating about this is that the problem seemed to be so widespread that the Vatican in 2019, for the first time ever, invited Protestants and people of other faiths into this annual conference that they do at the Vatican on exorcism. And that was really the first time, that was a really notable moment where they wanted to exchange ideas and they brought others in to address this issue as well.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to talking through some of the examples you cite in the book. And also talking to Michael, of course, who joins us today. Michael, when I read the title of your latest book, Giving the Devil His Due, I thought, oh, maybe you've written a book on a similar topic. But I don't think that's actually exactly what the subject matter is.
Although There he is. Well, this is a collection of essays largely focused on free speech and free thought and defending the not just the First Amendment in the United States, but just the concept of the freedom to think and say whatever you want from any kind of censorship, mostly the private kind with, cancel culture on social media, that kind of thing. I'm very critical of that. I think the only way to get to the truth is to have an open conversation, like what we're doing today.
Exactly.
Anyway, that's what that book is about. The devil is whoever disagrees with you. And the reason he should be given his due is because that's the only way to find out if you're onto something or if you've gone off the rails or and even if you're partially wrong or completely wrong in your beliefs. If you don't know what the other side is arguing, then how strong is your position to begin with? So, for example, my students at Chapman University, they're pretty liberal, so they're mostly pro-choice on the abortion issue. And when I asked them, what are the best arguments that the pro-lifers have, they pretty much don't even know what the arguments are. They've never heard of them. You know, they're anti-women or, you know, whatever. No, that's not – whatever they are in their hearts, those aren't arguments. You know, so I haven't watched like a Ben Shapiro video defending the pro-life position or a Dinesh D'Souza, you know, public intellectuals like that that defend pro-life. And they have pretty good arguments. And even if they come out at the end saying, well, I'm still pro-choice, well, okay, fine. But at least your pro-choice position is stronger now because you know what the other side is. So that's John Stuart Mill's classic line, he who knows only his own position doesn't even know that.
Well, I suspect there'll be quite a measure of agreement between you and Billy on that issue, at least yes. in the course of today's show. But what about this general area, though, of the demonic realm? What did you make of the way that Billy puts things in his book? And you know, where do you take a view on this whole area yourself as a skeptic, Michael?
I love the book. Here it is. And I listened to the audio edition. And, I think Billy and I are in agreement on most of the explanations because he's a journalist. And he does bring up many of the explanations that skeptics offer, like the ideomotor response for the Ouija board phenomenon, for example. And so when people say, well, I think the Ouija board is evidence of the supernatural or the paranormal, then I think when most skeptics go, well, no, that's the ideomotor response, I think probably most people like Billy or most rational Christians or whatever you want to call them would go, yeah, yeah, that's not actually evidence for the supernatural. We have other evidence for that, something like that. So I would say probably like with ufologists, the serious ones, I'm in agreement. They and me are in agreement on 90, 95% of the cases that we're trying to explain. So analogously, you know, the ufologists who construct this entire worldview of, you know, aliens have visited us on Earth, that's based on not this huge body of evidence, but actually about 5% of the anomalous, unexplained sightings and cases. And I would say that's probably the case also with demonic possession or you know, a devil, the existence of Satan or the devil or some kind of supernatural force like that. I would treat it no differently. That is to say, it's a claim about something supernatural as opposed to natural. And that, what do you do with the cases you can't explain? The anomalies that that remain open, that I don't know and you don't know, no one seems to know. You know, like one-off events. You know, I wasn't there. You weren't there. There's no video recording we can look at. We have eyewitness accounts, and that's it. And so here's probably the difference is that I'm willing – I just say I don't know. We can't explain everything. You know, there's this what's called a residue problem. There's always a residue of unexplained phenomenon in any field of science, of any kind of knowledge at all. And no theory explains everything. So what do you do with the unexplained anomalies? Well, you don't have to do anything with them. You can assign them to your graduate students to go figure out something like that. At least that's what we do in science. So where I suspect Billy makes this move that Christians do make is that, well, I'm not willing to give it up entirely. I will admit that, you know, this is explainable. That one's explicable. Science explains that one, this one. But what about that one right there? That one's really weird. And I'm willing to say I'm going to jump over the line and go, I think that is actually a case of the paranormal or the supernatural. Whereas I stay on the other side of the line and go, no, I'm just going to say sure. I'm skeptical until we know more.
Well, look, it'll be fascinating to tease this out between you both as we go through the show. Maybe before we leap into sort of the natural versus supernatural explanation for some of this stuff, tell us some of the stories in the book, Billy. I mean, you open the whole book with three cases, both historic and more recent, which you've looked into. For instance, there's the story of Robbie Mannheim, which comes from the 1940s, and I believe his story is what the famous Exorcist film was based on. You've interviewed also Bob Cranmer, who has an extraordinary story as well, and as a relatively well-known, well-to-do person, hadn't apparently no gain from inventing the sort of stories he tells of demonic activity in his house. But I thought maybe one we could focus on, which you also do a chapter on, is the Ammon House case in Gary, Indiana, because that was relatively recent, wasn't it? I remember this sort of, even here in the UK, hearing about this and it being featured on some news outlets and things. So tell us about this particular case.
Yeah, that particular case is fascinating. And here's why. The number one reason as a journalist, right? I'm a Christian first, but I'm a journalist, and I'm really captivated by stories that have a lot of sourcing and by stories that make their way into a mainstream outlet. So you've got the Indianapolis Star. They're covering this story of this alleged possession. This woman, her mother, so it's a mom, a grandma, and three grandchildren, living in this house in Gary, Indiana. And within 4 months of living at this house, they claim to be experiencing all sorts of crazy things. And what was so remarkable was that this story, before I go into the details, again, it made its way into a mainstream newspaper. That doesn't happen very often. And the Robbie story, which we could talk about after, that also made its way into the Washington Post in the late 1940s, which doesn't happen. And, you know, you don't put something in a newspaper, and every journalist knows this, unless you have enough sourcing to at least say there's something here, right? You don't want to be laughed off the stage. And what made that Gary, Indiana story so fascinating was that there was a lot there. So, circling back, they had all this chaos in the house, and the family, of course, you know, the police start to find out about this. Child services starts to find out about this because the behavior of the children and the mother was apparently so erratic that they got involved. So they're at the doctor's office one day, and the mother's telling this story. The kids are acting erratic, and of course, they call an ambulance. And the doctor who is in this office is on the record saying, in my 20 years of practicing medicine, I've never heard or seen anything so wild in my life. So they take the family off to the hospital. At this point, Child Services gets involved. And this is where the story, and I think this is where skeptics would roll their eyes or laugh. But again, you have these people who have gone on the record saying that they have experienced and seen these things. And in this particular case, they're at the hospital. They're talking to a CPS, a child services worker, and they're talking to a nurse. And so there's more than one person in the room, and you've got the grandma, the mother, one of the kids. And I smile every time I tell it because it sounds ridiculous. But apparently, according to the official report from the child services expert, the child holding his grandmother's hand started to walk up the side of the wall, did a flip, and landed on his feet. And so when I first heard this, of course, I thought this is ridiculous. And you go and you track down the original sourcing, you go and look at that report. And sure enough, there is a well-documented report of the events that apparently happened in this hospital room. There was a nurse who has also corroborated those events. So that's one element of the story. The mother actually lost her children for a time because the behavior was so erratic, what was going on with the children. And during that time, you have police officers who come to get involved in this case, naturally, to investigate what is going on at the home. And these are police officers who are skeptical of the story, who don't believe that there's a possession going on. And they, too, come to believe that there's something going on in this home based on their experience. And so it was this strange collection of events that really culminated in an exorcism. There was a local priest who got permission to perform an exorcism on this particular woman. And, you know, there was apparently a resolution at the end of that. But I'm giving you the highlights of what is a very wild and, again, documented story. Yeah. And you don't get that very often.
And I mean, obviously, you mentioned one of the, if you like, highlights of that, this extraordinary story of a child walking up a wall and flipping over. But generally, the activity going on was, the reported activity, at least, was sort of things slamming, objects moving, things yes. flying across the room. Was this seen by anyone other than the mother and the children in this case? Were others saying they were seeing these things happen?
There was some levitating. There was a cousin who apparently saw that. So it was family members who saw some of that. But what was interesting is that the police officers experienced other things in the home. One of the cops, in fact, two of the cops were recording inside the home, and there was a voice that was apparently recorded speaking to them. When they left, they were going over their evidence. They heard this voice. That was one of the things that convinced them. There was a mysterious substance that was appearing with no source. It was an oily substance on the blinds in the home. The priest claims to have experienced things inside the home. The blinds, you know, the part of the blinds that you raise the blinds and lower the blinds, they were all moving back and forth in a certain motion. So there were things, you know, those bigger things people didn't see that the family saw in the home, but there were other elements. And actually, in addition to what I talked about with the kid walking up the wall, there's also a report in the hospital that was filed, the same report, in fact, where one of the children was attacking another one of the other children and speaking in another voice. You know, this was something that the family had reported. Mm. And so there were some other people who saw that happen as well.
Yeah. And just to sort of complete the story, what was the result of when the priest was brought in to try and make a difference?
It took a number of attempts, apparently, exorcism attempts. And the officers who were involved in this case were so captivated by it that they actually attended some of these exorcisms. There were three of them. And according to the priest and according to the woman involved, she was healed and never dealt with the issue again. And that was sort of where it was left. Now, this story took on, obviously, it was an international story. It was a massive story. And a lot of skeptics have looked at it. A lot of Christians have looked at it. My goal going into that story as a journalist is, okay, I don't need to talk to the family. They've been on the record. We know what they're going to say. I wanted to talk to the police officer, one of them who was involved, a sheriff. I wanted to talk with the priest. And so I tracked those people down. And again, I'm a lifelong Christian. So these things are not foreign to me. You know, these are things that I believe in personally, but yet I'm skeptical. I want to poke those holes in it. And so that was my goal going into each of these stories.
Michael, you must have come across this story, possibly even reported on it yourself and engaged with it at the time it was all happening. What was your sort of, what did you make of it? What, I mean, and have you had a chance to look into it in any depth since?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I'm just trying to remember on a particular detail, the backward walk, spider walk up the wall thing. Wasn't that originally in the Exorcist movie? And this is an event that happened later, right?
Well, Billy? So right. I haven't watched the Exorcism in years, but I would tell you, even if that's the case, what is fascinating about these stories and these claims is that they often have some of very similar. I'm sure there are stories of people doing the same thing before the Exorcist, right? So it's not an entirely foreign concept.
I mean, is your point, Michael, that this could be a learned behavior of some sort?
Not that it actually happened, because I don't know how you'd walk upside down up a wall on a spider walk unless you're a spider. It's just physically not possible. That would be supernatural for sure if it happened. No, I think more likely is that the description of it happening possibly was inculcated from the film. And, I don't want to accuse people of lying. People mistakenly misperceive things, forget things, remember things differently, confabulate their memories with other things that happened, and so on. That we know that happens a lot. And, so here then we have to invoke a few skeptical principles. You know, before you say something is out of this world, first make sure it's not in this world. Okay, so again, we can, agree 90% of these things are explicable by things in this world, natural explanations. What do you do with that other 5 or 10%? Well, okay, are those examples or evidence of supernatural? Well, what kind of evidence do we have? So here then I would evoke a second skeptical principle: extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, the so-called ICRA principle that made famous by Carl Sagan, but he wasn't the first to articulate it. Actually, David Hume did. That is, as he said, a man should proportion his confidence to the evidence, his beliefs to the evidence. And so the more extraordinary the claim, the better your evidence should be. And so if I tell you, for example, on my bike ride this morning, I went up the hill and I turned left and I went up this road and turned right and so on. And then at this particular corner, this spacecraft came over my head and abducted me and took me to the Pleiades, and I met the Pleiadians, and they told me, we should be careful about global warming. And then I came back and they put me back on my bike and I rode back home. Well, I don't need to provide you extraordinary evidence for my bike ride on this highway. You could take my word for it. But the part about where I went to the Pleiades, you'd go, hang on, Shermer, hang on now. We're going to need more than just your word for that. We're going to need some kind of, to grab a piece of the dashboard off the UFO, and bring it back so we can test it. So, and this was, David Hume's point, where in his chapter on miracles, Billy will be very familiar with this, in his Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, this is 1758, in his section 10 titled The Miracles, he provides a general, here I'm reading from one of the chapters in my book here, when all else fails, analysis of miraculous claims. That is, when one is confronted by a true believer whose apparently supernatural paranormal claim has no immediately apparent natural or normal explanation, Hume gives us an argument that even he thought was so important that he placed his own words in quotes and called it a maxim. Hume was not a modest man. I think it is so useful an argument that in my 1997 book, Why People Believe Weird Things, I called it Hume's maxim. Here is what he wrote. The plain consequence is, and it is generally maxim worthy of our attention, that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. Close quote from himself. Then he continues, when anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or that the fact which he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision, and always reject the greater miracle. If the falsehood of his testimony would be more miraculous than the event which he relates, then and not until then can he pretend to command my belief. So, like the resurrection, for example, obviously this is an important claim for Christians. If it's not true, then why bother to be a Christian? You might as well be a Jew or whatever. And so here, how extraordinary is that claim? Well, 100 billion people have lived and died before our 7.5 billion alive today. And every one of them has died, and not one has come back of that 100 billion, or maybe one. So how extraordinary is this claim, the resurrection? 100 billion to one. Okay, how extraordinary is the evidence in support of that 100 billion to 1 odds? It's pretty ordinary, you know, just eyewitness testimony. And so that's the point. Okay, so
Okay. Well, I don't want to get too bogged down in the specifics, but you've given a very, very detailed sort of explanation of the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence sort of view, the maxim. I mean, how does this apply then to this particular case, Billy? Because,
well, again, what's more likely, I mean, that the person that we talked to said they saw somebody walking up the wall? Okay, is that an accurate eyewitness account, or are they misremembering? They're conflating their memory with the movie they saw. You know, it's actually third hand, not first hand or second hand. We know that people will say something like, I'll just back up and give you studies on people that watch a magic trick. Okay, can you let me finish this? Yeah. People that watch a magic trick, when you ask them, tell us what you saw, they rarely get it right. You know, this is a famous one with Uri Geller bending spoons or bending a key. The people that watch it live, or they'll watch a video of it, they'll go, he never touched the key. This is never true. He always touches the key because it's the only way to bend a key, right? So they're misremembering. They're just forgetting, or they're retelling the story in a way that skeptics can't explain it. So I think that's more likely than that demons exist and then inhabited this body and caused the body to walk up the wall. Okay.
Sure. If you don't,
before we go to a break, Billy, go for it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if you don't believe in miracles, of course, it's more likely. If you do believe that these things are possible, not just miracles, but that there's another realm. You know, I sometimes think in the miracle discussion, and I know, Michael, you'll probably scoff at this, but, you know, I look at life itself as an improbable miracle. The fact that we're sitting here in consciousness, discussing this, breathing, living with trees in an ecosystem in a universe that is perfectly aligned to sustain that life, right? So I think we sometimes, and that's a whole other conversation, but I think we sometimes talk about natural and supernatural, whereas I sort of look at everything around us as essentially supernatural and what we're experiencing and living. But, you know, in this particular case, to your point, you know, I do think we have to be very careful. I can't tell anybody what to think, but when you don't have the evidence you've described, for instance, the magic trick, I think, is a really interesting example. You know, remembering in this case, you have people at a hospital who are assuming they've been called in an abuse case. They're not attending a magic trick knowing that they're going to see magic. They're attending to a situation that they believe is potentially involving abuse. And so they're showing up to that. And I think it would be a perfectly suitable argument to say that one person misremembered, but I do find it compelling as somebody who, you know, I love storytelling, I love interacting with people about their experiences. When you have two individuals and a second individual who is backing that story, and also family members in the room, so you're talking now about four people, who, not including the child who allegedly did this, right? And so you have this dynamic where people are backing the story, and not just backing it, but risking their career and putting these things into government documents that are going to be reported on in public, which is what happened. And you have the person, and I just find this compelling, and I would say for any viewers or listeners to think about this, the woman who filed this report left her job within, I think it was about a year, and has not been heard from again. This had a dramatic impact on her life and her career. So if she just simply misremembered something, leaving the state, moving away, and leaving your job, and I can't speak for her that that was the only reason, but there were sources I spoke with in covering the story who did affirm that this deeply impacted her, it seems to me she experienced something that she couldn't explain.
We're going to go to a quick break, gentlemen, and we'll be back. We'll continue discussing the Ammon case and indeed other instances of apparent supernatural exorcism and demonic activity. That's our subject today on Unbelievable, asking, are demons and exorcism for real? My guests are Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking about the demonic realm, demons, exorcism, ghosts, that kind of thing. Billy Halliwell's new book, Playing with Fire, is a modern investigation into all of these sorts of things. And he's very much tackling it as a journalist. And he's not saying he believes everything he hears, but he's heard some pretty interesting stuff, stuff that's hard to explain away. But can Michael Shermer, our skeptical guest on the programme today, well, he says at the end of the day, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and he hasn't heard anything or seen anything yet that would merit really kind of saying, yes, there must be some supernatural basis to this stuff. Now, that may not change the course of today's show, but it'll be interesting to see what the discussion looks like as we look at some of these specific cases. Now, Michael, before we leap back into to the Ammon case and the specifics of it, I mean, as Billy has said, lots of people around this case, not just the family involved, the police officers, the support workers, they all said weird things were happening, strange things going on. So there's an element of not everyone saw the same thing, not everyone will have exactly the same testimony inevitably, but certainly strange things going on, things that don't normally happen in everyday life. And there are many, many, many other examples where people have reported, you know, unexplained incidences, things going on that don't seem to have an obvious material cause. Now, is it your view that in these cases, there's always got to be either some sort of material cause, that the blinds were moving because there was actually a draft that no one knew about coming through a window, mm-hmm. or it's a mental issue, it's a psychological issue? For you, is that always the preferable explanation with anything that is otherwise being attributed to demonic activity?
It is, and it should be for you too, because in fact the Catholic Church for centuries has had a devil's advocate, the Advocatus Diaboli, the essentially skeptic of the church, because they get so many stories of miracles, and people want their preferred deceased priest or whoever to be canonized and turned into a saint. And so they've had to say, okay, we have to set up some criteria here because most of this stuff is a bunch of malarkey. And they know it's malarkey. They, you know, the bleeding statues and the weeping paintings and so forth. And, you know, oh, we detected the oil or there was, you know, milk coming out of the eyes of the statue, whatever. And the Catholic Church would send their devil's advocate and figure, oh, no, it's not. It's oil coming from the wood in the ceiling dripping down. Oh, okay, not a miracle, not a miracle, not a miracle. They debunk most of the miracle claims because they know, you know, the 10,000 given to them, you know, 99% of them are explicable. Now, so they still hang out for that 1%. I'm just making these numbers up, but you get the idea. You know, and so to become yeah, a saint, to become a saint in the Catholic Church, you have to go through this whole process. You know, you got to have two big miracles and three small miracles or whatever it is. And, you know, they kind of fast-track Mother Teresa because she allegedly healed somebody who had MS because the MS went into remission at some point. And it's like, yeah, but from my perspective, you know, you were good skeptics all the way up into that one. How do you know? Because MS does go into remission periodically. So how do you know that it didn't just naturally happen, as these things do, or it was because that person touched the dress of Mother Teresa and that's what healed her multiple sclerosis? Yeah, I think that was the example they used for her. So again, you know, it's kind of a signal detection problem. That is to say, how do you know it's a hit? When you've eliminated, you know, miss, that one, okay, what's the criteria for tipping over that one into the paranormal or supernatural or any kind of hit? This would be true for any scientific particular claim, you know, a UFO site. That's the one. We know this one was swamp gas and that one was Venus and this one was airplanes and this one was geese, but that one. And it's usually along the lines of what we're talking about. It's like really, really, really unusual, like three standard deviations out from the mean. And again, law of large numbers, if you have enough people, you know, 7.5 billion people just doing stuff every day, and you have a bell curve, you know, most of it is just kind of normal human activity. But you get way out here in the margins, 3-4 standard deviations out from what normally happens. Inevitably, with so many people doing so many things, you'll have just a few every night, some really weird thing that they usually run the last 5 minutes of the newscast if they have video. And so inevitably, the weird stuff does happen if you have enough things happening. I mean, really unusual coincidences. You know, like there's a story about Anthony Hopkins getting cast as a character in one of his films. and he went to this bookstore to get a copy of the book to read it first, and they were out of it. So he's walking to the tube station in England, and there's a book on a bench. So he picks the book up at the bench. It's the book that he needs, and it's like, whoa, really unusual. Then it's like 6 months later, they're on the film set, and he's with the producer, and the producer says, oh, yeah, I lost my copy of the book. And Anthony's like, holds up his copy. He goes, well, I got this one. It's the same book that guy lost. Okay. That is freakily unusual. And yet no one says, well, that's demonic or paranormal. It's just coincidental.
Billy, well, it's interesting because one of the things about this topic that I find fascinating is when you talk to anthropologists or other experts, and you would know this too, Michael, that this is an experience, this experience of spiritual possession in some way. It's not just a Christian concept. It's Islam. There are plenty of other religions that have this. It's a very common human experience going back to the beginning of time, essentially. This is something we see popping up. And even today, more than 4 in 10 Americans believing that demons probably or very likely exist, that they've actually 4 in 10 Americans saying that they've had an experience in some way with ghosts or spirits. Now, that doesn't mean that they have, right? We have to be, and I actually would agree with you, Michael, that we have to go into these cases and we have to do it in a way that, just as you were saying, most cases end up not being true, right? But you have these circumstances, you have these cases, and you have this experience going back to the beginning of time that seems to point to this commonality. And yes, it manifests itself in different ways, through different lenses and different cultures, but there are commonalities among the ways in which it manifests itself. And so it's a complicated discussion, and you know this, because I can say, oh, there's all these things going on over here, and you can't prove it's not true. And you can say to me, well, you can't prove that it is true. And that's all true, right? This is what makes it so complex. But again, I would go back to the fact that you have these common experiences, and you look out in the modern era, you have people who are devoting their entire careers to trying to address some of these things. And it's not just this science versus religion thing. You've got an increasing number of psychiatrists and others who are coming forward and saying, you know what? I think there is something going on here. And I encountered in writing, Playing with Fire, so many people who had stories that they were afraid to share. They were afraid to look weird, or they were just afraid to share it. They didn't want to put their name on it publicly. And so I think there's a stigma around it. But to see some scientists and medical professionals coming forward and saying, look, I don't know what we're dealing with here, but I'm seeing something that I cannot explain scientifically or medically. And again, they come across an array. You've got people like Richard Gallagher who are out there, consulting for the Catholic Church, and you have others who are at least open to it. And from what I'm hearing, there's an increasingly large group of those people.
I did want to ask about Dr. Richard Gallagher, who you mentioned in the book. He's a psychologist who has for a long time looked at some of these cases and believes that he does see genuine demonic activity going on. You also mentioned M. Scott Peck, who's a well-known writer, of the past, and the fact that he also attributed as a psychologist certain spiritual forces going on. So evidently it's not that all psychologists take it must all be just a mental illness, delusional, whatever. There are obviously a certain segment of them who do see that there's room for a sort of spiritual demonic explanations for some kinds of behavior, Billy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And an increasing number. I mean, I've had people tell me off the record that there are certain hospitals that will call them a couple of times a year and will say, we need your help with this case. Please keep it quiet. So this is something that is going on. And I'm not saying that this is sweeping and that every psychiatrist and psychologist is doing this, but there are people out there who are. And in the case of Richard Gallagher, he was a skeptic. He was somebody who didn't really even think he believed in the devil or Satan. And he encountered an individual. The Catholic Church came to him. He encountered this woman. He thought it was going to disprove for him, or I guess prove his worldview at the time. And what happened was it essentially reinforced for him that this was something that was real. And the details of that story are really fascinating as well. And again, it's his claim versus, it's just his word. He's saying, I experienced this, but there were other people in those instances as well. And I find that compelling that when you have, how do you explain? I'm curious, Michael, because you probably do have an explanation for that. But when you have 5 to 7 people in a room who are claiming to have seen something extraordinary, not just like somebody's eye twitched, something completely insane that seems unbelievable, how do you explain that sort of dynamic away?
Yeah, That's harder, much harder to explain. Obviously, one person misperceiving or hallucinating or having an illusion is different than four or five in the room. On the other hand, we have like the you know, the miracle at Fatima in 1917, where supposedly 50,000 people saw the sun bouncing around the sky and collapsing and coming back up, and the earth stopped turning, and so on. And somehow people elsewhere on the planet failed to notice this. Well, do we really have 50,000 people? Well, we have an account that says 50,000 people saw this. You know, we don't have 50,000 independent accounts. But in any case, it reminds me of also Satya Sai Baba in India, you know, who was from, say, 1890s through the 1950s or so, was a miracle worker. You know, he raised people from the dead, brought them back to life. He caused, you know, people to heal that had cancer, and he did this miracle and that miracle. And millions of people believe it, and there's accounts where many, many people saw him perform the miracle. At least that's what the accounts we hear, you know, and yet when I ask Christians this, they go, well, no, of course, we don't believe Satya Sai Baba was anything like Jesus. He's not a miracle worker. He was a fakir, F-A-K-I-R. He was a magician or whatever he was doing. He wasn't doing real miracles. Well, why don't you believe that? I mean, I can show you the sources, you know, that people in the 20th century said, we saw it. Lots of people in the room at the same time. So, and I presume you're skeptical of Satya Sai Baba. Why be skeptical of him and not of that account of the four people in the room that saw the spider?
And in a sense, and I was going to say that there are, of course, other from other religious traditions, accounts of demonic possession and exorcism in Islam and elsewhere, mm-hmm. Billy. So I suppose it's a valid point. You know, are you willing to accept those if you're willing to kind of give credence to the Christian sort of forms of it as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we'd have to accept exorcism in any culture. It could happen anywhere, because we're told that as Christians, if we're going to put on my Christian hat, you know, scripture is pretty clear that this can happen, and it seems to actually happen more often than not. It doesn't seem to be something that happens to Christians. You know, spiritual oppression, which is something a little different, could happen to everyone, but possession is actually something that would mostly be happening to people who are outside of the Christian realm and don't have that protection from a biblical sense. That's the assumption, right? So I think the question is whether or not it's being healed properly. That's where the Christian would have the debate over that discussion, right? Is it possible to heal those things, you know?
It raises for me that whole question of whether we're slightly insulated potentially, Michael, in the West, in the secular, rationalistic, if you like, West. I've got an interview coming out shortly on my Unbelievable show with a fascinating Ugandan pastor, very intelligent man, very rational man. But what he said to me when we talked about this issue, he said, the problem is, Justin, you live in the West. If you lived here, if you saw what happens here, you can't deny the reality of a supernatural realm, he said. And a lot of people have said this to me, that you go somewhere else and suddenly your eyes are opened to the fact that weird stuff really does happen a lot more than we maybe think. Now, is that just because they're less educated, they're less rational, they're less scientific?
What's
going on?
No, Michael? Well, yeah, what's going on there? Well, analogously, you know, the postmodern movement, the intersectional theory, the critical race theory, this is a completely different subject, but related in this sense. They claim also that the Western way of knowing through science and reason and objective knowledge is itself kind of a dominant culture, white patriarchal way of knowing, and that there are other ways of knowing that are non-Western or non-patriarchal, non-white. And I know, Billy, you're not claiming this. I'm just analogously. And so, okay, well, what are other legitimate ways of knowing? Well, the lived experience. So their claim would be, for example, I as a white male cannot possibly know what it means to be a black female. And her lived experience of just her telling me what her life is like is legitimate knowledge. Okay, maybe I get that subjectively. Personally, yes, I can't know what's in your heart or your mind. But on the other hand, if we make a claim about something external to the world, external to my experience and your experience, then there has to be some way for us to get at it, or else it's just us talking and sharing opinions or shared experiences. They may be true, they may not be true. True for you is one thing, true objectively for all of us to look at it and go, that's the case. Yeah. So, yes, of course, I recognize different cultures have different experiences. And, you know, what's true for them is not true for me. Okay, fine. Subjectively, I'm fine with that. But if the moment you then make that leap into the claim of reliable objective knowledge. It's true whether I looked at it or you looked at it. Here's the footage. You see it. I can see it. You know, it's there. That's a different kind of claim, and that's what we're doing here. We're talking about not just different cultures have experiences of demonic possession or whatever, and that's their lived experience. We're making a different kind of claim. It's really true. There really is a demon or Satan existing in the world today.
Well, I think this is obviously the essence of faith, is believing things that you cannot see. But the interesting thing about the world is that, you know, from a Christian perspective, I think there's a lot that you can see. And what fascinates me about this topic, as you go into these examples, and I'm not saying that all the stories in Playing with Fire are true, because I can present the evidence, I can present somebody's story, and I can let people come up with their own explanation. But when I look at the evidence embedded in those, they seem to line up in many of the cases to what we see in Scripture, which as a Christian is fascinating to me. And as you know, as I journey through that and I was working through the book, it really wasn't lost on me that looking at the examples that we see in Scripture, and for Michael, this obviously wouldn't be compelling, but for me it was. It was very compelling to see, wow, you know, I had never isolated evil out, right, in Scripture and looked at, okay, what does the Bible say about Satan? What does the Bible say about evil? What are these? Let me read through these stories of healing that Jesus apparently did that Christians believe is true. And what are the elements of that that we can pull out of that? And we see a lot of similarities. And so I understand. I think it's a fair assessment to say that you can't just take somebody's claim and say that it's true. But this is what we do often in the court of law. And sometimes people are let off when we don't have enough evidence. And I think in this case, Michael would be letting, you know, this sort of thing off because we wouldn't have enough evidence. But you're relying on witness testimony. You're relying on the things that people have experienced and gone through. I think we look at, you know, psychic abilities, for instance, which there are a lot of hucksters and liars out there. But it's actually one of the most fascinating elements of this discussion to me, and one of the most compelling, that there are. I have actually experienced this personally, where I've been in a circumstance where somebody, and I do not recommend as a Christian that people should be consulting psychics. I wasn't doing that, but I was in the realm of listening to somebody who happened to do it in an impromptu way, and they knew things there was no way that they could have known. You then move into the explanation of, well, how is that possible? Well, for the Christian, there are plenty of explanations of how that's possible. We see it throughout Scripture. So again, for me, I'm a storyteller. I look at stories, and when enough people are telling me that they've experienced something, I have to look at that and try to understand it. Now, I know that's not enough for you, Michael, but I do think it's enough for a lot of people, which is why we have, you know, nearly 50% of the country saying, yeah, you know, in America, we do believe that maybe demons exist. There's something there for them.
I mean, the other thing I want to get to, and love to hear Michael's response to this in a moment as well, is kind of at the other end of this, is the fact that very frequently, alongside accounts of demonic activity and so on, there does seem to be some kind of relief or solution to the problem when a priest, or in some other religion, someone from another position, does some kind of exorcism. And you detail a number of the stories where someone has apparently been freed from this form of oppression that was going on. Now, for you, Billy, is that evidence that actually there's something to this because something happened? You know, the medical experts hadn't been able to stop this happening, the scientists hadn't, but the priest could. What is that for you, a validation in a sense that this is a supernatural event rather than just a natural cause?
So I'm going to answer yes, but I want to answer that in a little bit of a different way, because this experience writing this really got me thinking a lot more about goodness, right? About Christ as a Christian, thinking about what does it mean? What did Jesus do for us, right? And the more I looked at the evil, the more it pointed me back to the need for the good. And as a journalist, I've written about 14,000 stories, and a good bulk of them have been stories of people who have been transformed by a relationship with Jesus, right? And there are lots of things that can transform people, but my experience in covering those stories, I went into journalism as a Christian in my mind, right? I believed it, you know, probably Michael, I know a little bit of your story. You know, I don't know, maybe you were even more devout than I was at that time beforehand when you were a believer. But, you know, I kind of believed it in my head because my parents told me to. And then I got to a point where working on all these stories, I was blown away by the ways in which the gospel changes people. A porn star who becomes one of the world's most famous porn stars becomes a preacher's wife and becomes a Christian, and her whole life changes. I mean, the list of stories is incredible. And that really resonated with me, seeing that and then looking at these healings. Right now we're going on the other side of it, and we're looking at these dramatic encounters that people have had where they have found healing. Again, now we're talking about possession, but through Christ, or they had some sort of spiritual oppression issue and they're finding healing through Christ. I would argue that you will not see another thing with the volume and the number of people changing, not just heart change, life change dramatically, that you would see through people who have encountered Christ, whether it be through finding him or through that sort of healing. So I would have to say the short answer is yes.
Now, in a sense, I suppose, Michael, if someone finds some form of healing or release or freedom, whether it be through an apparently religious source or a secular psychologist, I suppose you welcome the fact they've had a free form of freedom. But I suppose you do question whether it was a supernatural thing or whether it was ultimately psychological, even if a priest was involved in giving a person that relief by proclaiming a blessing over them or, an exorcism ritual.
Yeah, of course. Whatever gets you through the night. If it's private knowledge or some kind of claim and it makes you feel better. And, we all need that. I mean, all of us cling to certain beliefs that are true for us that work. And we're not making claims to objective knowledge. So, for example, my friend Martin Gardner, the late Martin Gardner, he had the Scientific American column before I had it. And, he was one of the hardcore founding members of the modern skeptical movement, debunking Uri Geller and psychics and things like that. But he was a fideist. He believed in God. He believed that there was an afterlife. He believed in prayer. And he said openly, I can't prove any of this. I think the atheists have slightly better arguments than theists for God's existence and so on and so forth. But he defended it. This fideism business is kind of a pragmatism. It works for me. And in certain areas of life, you can't do this all the time, but for certain things that can't be ultimately proved or disproved, God's existence, the afterlife, and free will were the three ones he brought up. So, for example, I'm a compatibilist. I think we do have volition and free will, although I acknowledge the determinists have slightly better arguments, but I still think we're part of the causal net and we have free will and we change the determining factors of the universe. Anyway, this goes on and on. But that, to me, is kind of a useful fiction. Otherwise, why would I bother to get out of bed if I didn't feel I had some volition, right? And I think most of us do that. So in that sense, what Billy was saying, yes, absolutely, it's true. There's tons of stories of people that find Jesus as their savior and it changes their life. Good. That's great. Whatever it takes. Other people in the last couple of years have turned to Jordan Peterson. They find Jordan Peterson is like their savior and they buy his 12 Rules for Life book and they study each of the 12 rules and it changed their life. And, maybe other people find that in Tony Robbins or whatever. Now, I'm not equating Jordan Peterson with Jesus or Tony Robbins with Jesus, but it's that, what is it that causes people to change their thoughts and behaviors? Well, lots of different things. And when I was a Christian and I was at Pepperdine, we heard those stories. And when you're in that world, yes, it's internally coherent and consistent, and there's lots of reinforcement of that belief system. But again, anthropologists will tell you, well, yes, but in other cultures, lots of things can lead to, a better, improved life of these kinds of beliefs that have nothing to do with Christianity, say, for example. By the way, let me note parenthetically before I forget. We kind of have this idea that psychiatry is now such a good science that we can rule out demonic possession because we understand what the cause is of psychoses and schizophrenia and paranoid delusions and so on. We don't. The science of psychiatry is still really crude. It's still really backwards. And there's a lot of subjective knowledge there about what constitutes a schizophrenic. They have this DSM, the DSM 2, 3, 4, now we're up to 5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that psychiatrists use. It's still really fraught with a lot of pseudoscience and nonsense in there. And we've run stories about this and skeptic, and so don't think that, it's science versus religion and science has explained all mental illness or anything like what you're talking
sure.
about. We don't.
Yeah. What was interesting to me in the book, in a sense, Billy, was that there are those situations where in extremis, the secular psychologist will ring up the priest and say, I've tried everything at my end. Would you have a go now? Presumably, in that case, a lot of psychologists are still going to be thinking it's a psychosomatic thing, the presence of a priest figure, the sort of incantation, the rites and so on. If that psychologically helps that person and releases them from this idea that they're possessed, then we've got to it one way or the other. We've done what we wanted to do. What for you makes you feel that actually it's more than just a kind of a psychological thing, that when someone is prayed over by a priest or exorcised in that way, that there's actually a genuine spiritual dimension to what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was asking those questions of numerous people who have worked in this field for a long time. Some of them are unnamed in the book because they didn't want to be named. And it was interesting to ask that question of, okay, well, if somebody comes to you, how do you tell whether or not they're dealing with a spiritual issue? You know, because that's what Richard Gallagher and others do. I mean, their job is to try to figure out, is this something I can explain medically? And if I can't, then, you know, I'm going to forward it off to the church and let them sort of deal with it. And it was fascinating to hear them say, well, if it's an issue that was spiritual, or if it was an issue that was mental, rather, nothing spiritual, it wouldn't react to it. You know, they were very clearly able to see that difference. I mean, if somebody is truly mentally ill, I mean, think about the symptoms we're talking about here: growling, speaking in different voices, different personalities, essentially dealing with circumstances that are severe mental illnesses in many cases, if we're to believe that's what they are. That spiritual element shouldn't be able to just suddenly cure them. Even the presence of a faith leader, I mean, I would assume that wouldn't be enough in most cases, you know, and so that's compelling to me, right? But that when there was a spiritual issue and they were able to pinpoint that, they were able to deal with it, and those people wouldn't return with those same issues again. And so there seemed to be, and of course, you have to be very careful. There are also stories in the book, as you know, of people who have abused this, right? I mean, there's the people who see a demon under every rock, and there's the people who don't believe in them at all. And so the idea would be that both of those perspectives could potentially be dangerous to somebody who, if we're going to say that this is real, is actually dealing with something that they're not being treated for, right? On either end, whether it's a mental illness or a spiritual illness. So it's compelling to me to hear those experts talk through that. But again, severe mental illness shouldn't be something that you could just pray away, correct? I mean, that would be my assumption.
Yeah, we're going to go to another break, and I want to come back to you, Michael, for more in just a moment's time. Appreciate there's so much we could talk about here, and we've only got another 10 or 15 minutes to go, but we'll come back to it. Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer, my guests on today's show, asking, are demons and exorcism for real? And I'll make sure you get links to both of them as well before we finish today's show. Hey, welcome back to the show. It's Justin Brierley with you on Unbelievable, and the final part of the conversation between Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer coming up very shortly. Just to say a shout out to Lily, who got in touch this week via email to say, I'm so grateful for the show, which hosts some of the most interesting and important conversations. Following the recommendations of books from certain guests has led me to some life-changing eureka moments and contributed to my conversion from no religion to Christianity. I especially enjoy listening to the thoughts of other scientists who, like me, see no conflict between their work and faith. Thanks and God bless, Lily. What a lovely, encouraging message to receive. Thank you very much. Glad you're a listener. And you can get in touch with the show yourself by emailing unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll hear some of your responses to the transgender and Christianity discussion between Preston Sprinkle and Reverend Christina Beardsley a little bit later on in the show. If you want to reach out via social media, @unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page of the show. I'm also on Instagram @justin.briley. You can even find me over on TikTok as well, posting some short sort of apologetics related videos there on a regular basis too. That's also justin.briley on TikTok. But looking forward to what's coming up later this evening. If you can stick around here on Premier Christian Radio at 8 p.m. on The Profile, you can hear our very own Ruth Jackson talking to Rochelle Ann Goh, star of the stage show Hamilton, about her Christian faith and acting career, and even the prayer circle she's instituted backstage during the show's Broadway run. She's The Profile in this month's Premier Christianity magazine. That's tonight at 8 p.m. or on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcasts from. And next week on this show, Richmond Wandera joins me. He's a Ugandan pastor and an unbelievable listener. He has an amazing story of coming from the slums of Kampala through to theological education, now oversees a network of church leaders in East Africa. We're going to be talking about things like witchcraft, Christianity, and the prosperity gospel in Africa. So look out for that conversation on The Unbelievable Show at the same time next week. For now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. What an interesting discussion as well we've been having on Are Demons and Exorcism for Real? My guests, Billy Hallowell and Michael Shermer. Again, Billy's new book is Playing with Fire, a modern investigation into demons, exorcism and ghosts. Go to billyhallowell.com for more information. Michael Shermer, a well-known atheist, founder in chief of Skeptic Magazine, joins us too. His most recent book is Giving the Devil His Due. No, it's not on exorcism. It's more on the culture wars around, identity politics and whether we can, have academic freedom and no platforming and that sort of thing. So check that out as well. MichaelShermer.com for more on Michael. And Billy, just before we do come back to Michael, one interesting aspect of this is the rise of sort of almost the occult as a form of entertainment. Ouija boards have, been around probably, I think, since the late 19th century. I think you said that's when they really came into the public eye. And they've been referenced already up at the beginning of the show, and it'd be interesting to talk about what's going on in Michael's view with a Ouija board thing. But in your view, are they a sort of an opening, in your view, this kind of playing with the occult to serious forces? I mean, and you're speaking now as a Christian, I understand, and that's inevitable in the show. But what's your view on those sorts of things, the Ouija board thing?
As a Christian, I would say, yeah, it can be an opening, right? I mean, this is something, and people will laugh about this. It's a toy. And I understand, I include this in the book, obviously, the scientific explanations of what could be going on when the planchette is moving around, right? But when you look at this, again, I, as a Christian, putting my Christian hat on, going into scripture and looking at the many times that we are warned to avoid speaking to clairvoyants, to avoid speaking to people, to mediums, to not try to practice necromancy, to not speak with the dead, all of these things that we are told not to do. And it's not just something in the Old Testament we're told not to do. We see it in the New Testament as well. And it's quite fascinating looking at that. I had covered the Ouija board as, a journalist around Halloween. We would have fun with it, sort of telling the history of it. But I hadn't gone as deep into the history of the Ouija board. And I found it actually fascinating, but also troubling. Again, this is something people view as a toy, but this was something that was being used as a tool to try to communicate with the dead. Exactly the sole purpose of what it's for now, which of course is parlor games, but what's the parlor game? Trying to communicate with the dead. That is the entire premise of why somebody would use a Ouija board. And so we can laugh about it all day, but there are many people, and some can say they believe this is mental illness, or some can say they believe it's spiritual, who have experienced things after using the Ouija board that we would count under this discussion as being demonic in general. And for some people, it has been a major impediment and a major problem. Now, that doesn't mean that I think probably 95% of the people or more who have used it, maybe even 99% have never experienced any sort of issue. But when you're putting your stake in something that you're trying to actually communicate with the dead, it becomes problematic. And I would just close that off by saying that during war times, we have seen the Ouija board explode in usage, especially World War I, World War II, because people were desperate, legitimately, to communicate with those lost loved ones. And so it's a much broader discussion, but I would absolutely say that this is something like any other thing, going to see a psychic, trying to figure out, the future in some way, that can lead you down that sort of path that would open something potentially negative in your life.
So what do you think is going on with the Ouija board? You mentioned earlier the phenomenon. Just explain what you think at a sort of skeptical level, Michael, is actually happening when people play the Ouija board and think that the words are being spelt out and answers given to them and so on.
Well, Billy gives the perfect explanation. It is our skeptical explanation, or the scientific explanation, the ideomotor effect. The ideomotor effect, so ideo, idea, and the motor motions. We know our thoughts cause signals to travel from the motor cortex down to your neurons that cause your muscles to fire and so on. This is what happens. Most of it happens subconsciously. I mean, when you walk or ride a bike or whatever, play tennis, you're not consciously thinking about what muscles to contract. So most muscle movements happen subconsciously. So with the ideomotor response, you're just thinking, I'm going to go left or right or whatever, and you just do. And it's not just the Ouija board effect. Sometimes it's called that. But in fact, all water dowsing is the ideomotor effect. The whole point of a water dowsing device, you can just take a couple of coat hangers and bend them over, and you have the little things just going like this. You walk around, or you can buy some of these that are even more loosely made, so they really swing a lot. If they're delicately balanced, they will go left or right, or they'll cross, and that's the place where you should drill for water or whatever. So this has all been tested by skeptics, by scientists, and so on. And it's just the person making it move, and they're not aware of that. So in the case of dowsers, you know, it turns out pretty much anywhere you drill, if you drill down deep enough, you're going to find water. So it doesn't matter where they point the water dowsing sticks to. But if you tell them, you know, like I do these experiments with my students, because I have this golf ball finder, which is basically a water dowsing device, but it finds golf balls. So the owner tells the golfers who buy it. If you set up in the room two opaque cups, one has a golf ball in it and the other one has nothing in it, if the person knows where it is, the sticks always go right there. If they don't know, it's 50-50. So here's a simple scientific test. Is it real? Does it really work or not? Well, you have to be able to do better than 50-50. How much better than 50-50? Well, we know exactly how many hits you'd have to get for us to say at the 95% confidence level, it's statistically significantly different than if it was just random chance. And I think it was like you have to get 69 out of 100 instead of 50 out of 100. And that would make it statistically significantly likely not due to chance. Okay, so we have an actual perfect criteria there. Okay, with the Ouija board, you could do, well, Penn and Teller did this. I think, Billy, you referenced the Penn and Teller episode where they actually blindfolded the two people using it, and they flipped it around, and they were just spilling out nonsense. I've used the Ouija board. When I was, let's see, my sister, I think, was 7 or 8, so I think I must have been 18 or 19. So just for fun, and I was a Christian at the time. So I forget where I got the Ouija board, but anyway, I'm playing it with my sister, and she is freaking out because she's not moving it, and I'm not trying to move it. I'm trying not to move it. And still, this thing is moving around. Now, we didn't do the blindfold thing. I just asked it, who is moving this? And it spelled out T-E-S-S-A, Tessa. That's the name of the spirit, moving the planchette. And my little sister, she's freaking out, and I'm kind of an evil older brother, you know, like, haha, this is really fun. And eventually, you know, it spelled out ripe old age when I asked why it died and when did it live, 15th century it spelled out. Anyway, it was quite powerful. And at the time, I was a believer, so I thought, whoa, this is kind of freaky. You know, and then later when I read about the ideomotor response, I said, well, obviously I'm moving this thing, or my sister is, or neither one of us knows. And it really does work. I mean, sometimes for some people it takes a while. You have to kind of get comfortable and relaxed, and it maybe takes 10 or 15 minutes. A lot of people give up too early. But for most people, it will move. That is, they're moving the planchette, right? So Billy is just as much a skeptic about the Ouija board, I think, as I am, at least for those. But at some point, you just take that one little move. You make that one more move. Go, but it could lead to something that's real. Okay, what's the criteria?
I was going to ask on this. So Billy, you're very open to the idea that actually, in the vast majority of the cases, there is this ideomotor sort of reaction going on. But so what for you is the danger in the Ouija board?
Well, you know, I think that there are a lot of people who would use it because they're desperately trying to actually use it. A lot of people are picking it up, and I can't prove those numbers. I mean, we also, it's very hard to test out something like the Ouija board from a spiritual, now I'm going to put on the Christian hat, from a spiritual perspective. If this is something that doesn't want to be detected and tested, then of course it's going to be hard to detect and test. And, you know, we see this across the board with a lot of these things. I know that for Michael and others, that might sound like an excuse for leaving a door open that this could work. But for people who are desperately using it, and I've known people who have done this because they truly are trying to seek answers, you know, whatever you're putting that hope and that faith in that realm can really open you up. And I've actually personally known people who have gone through things that were attached to this, and this was one part of that obsession. People who were so infatuated with the Ouija board that they would spend 8 hours at a time in a room using this, desperately trying to seek that out. And so I think the danger is trying to tap into this other realm, right, that we are not intended to tap into, and not everybody believes that exists. But I'm also, you know, highly skeptical of claims of, well, we've tested it and it doesn't work and this explains it. And when you've got 4 or 5 people's hands on it, the assumption that only one of them is moving it, yeah, I think that gets a little problematic. But it's one of those things we're never going to be able to prove. But I do think that the history of the board actually is fascinating in that it was created, you know, with a medium, Helen Peters, who was heavily involved in that process, taking part in it, and it was marketed to make money. And there are a lot of other elements of that story that are curious and bizarre. My recommendation would be avoid it. Don't use the Ouija board because you don't know what it could open you up to. But I would say that in the majority of cases, most people may have no issue.
Yeah. Michael, as we start to draw the show together, obviously in, for you, the natural explanation must always come primary, because as you say, as far as you're concerned, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence, and you know, it simply can't overturn the vast majority of cases in which there are natural explanations for these kinds of phenomena. Even so, it does leave that weird category of strange, mysterious, unexplained things. I mean, there was even a fascinating article for your own column in Scientific American where you talked about a spooky radio set. Do you mind telling that story again, just briefly, for the audience? And the fact that even for you, a skeptic like you, it gave you pause for thought.
Here's the radio.
Hey, there it is. If you're watching my video, Michael has the very radio.
The very radio. It's my wife's radio. Yes, here it is. It's a Philips 1977 transistor radio that my wife had shipped to me when she before she moved here from Germany to be with me, which I still consider a small miracle.
See, you do believe in miracles.
Yeah, you see, it's a miracle. Yeah. And any case, her. She was raised by her single mom and grandfather, and anyway, he's gone now, and so she was kind of missing him when we decided to get married. And I had tried to make the radio work. I put new batteries in, and I did the old bam bam to try to get it to work. technique. Nothing worked. Anyways, it was dead for months in this drawer. I threw it in. In fact, it was on this desk that I'm sitting at here. And then the day we got married, we got married at the courthouse in Beverly Hills, and then had a little ceremony at my house. And so she needed kind of a quiet moment. Because she was missing her, none of her family was there because they're in Germany and we're in California. And so she was missing her grandfather in particular. And then all of a sudden this music starts playing when we're in the back room just having a quiet moment. And it's like, where's this music come from? I don't have a stereo system in the house. My laptop is closed. The iPhone is in the other room, so it doesn't just play anyway. And so I open this drawer, and here's this radio, and it's playing perfect music. It's like perfectly tuned to the station playing romantic music. And it's like, oh, that's weird. So I took it out there and go, hey, everybody, this is really cool. They're like, what? Anyway, so I played the rest of the day and night, and then the next day it was dead. It's been dead ever since. And, you know, so I wrote about this in Scientific American. I didn't commit to, you know, now I'm a believer in the supernatural. I just said, look, you know, weird things happen. And when the timing is good and it has emotional significance for you, just enjoy the mystery. That's okay. It's fine. You know, we don't have to explain everything. Well, boy, did I get a lot of mail. I mean, first of all, you know, Shermer, you've gone round the bend. You know, you've lost your mind. But more importantly, I got a lot of letters from people that had stuff like that happen. Just, I mean, they would go on for pages of just really unusual stuff. And meaningful to them, that, you know, connected them with a lost loved one, this kind of thing. Deepak Chopra even wrote me. He's a friend. Shermer, it has to do with love, the connectedness and the synchronicity. And, you know, now Deepak, he's not obviously a Christian. He's kind of a Buddhist or Western Buddhist or whatever he is. But he still thinks, like, along the lines that you do, Billy, that this stuff is interconnected. There is this other realm. He thinks it's consciousness that has to do with quantum physics and quantum fields and so on. And so I'm open to all of these things being possible. In fact, I go so far as to say there's no such thing as the paranormal or the supernatural. There's just the normal, the natural, and stuff we can't explain. So let's say, for example, it turned out that ghosts are real and they live, you know, that the pattern of your soul, your information that constitutes you, floats off the brain when you die and it goes into a quantum field. You know, this is what Deepak thinks, you know, like a quantum consciousness. And then it could reemerge in some other place, some other time. Okay, this is not impossible. Not likely, but not impossible. And if it turned out that was true, that wouldn't be supernatural. That would just be quantum physics and consciousness. It would be part of the natural world that we just don't understand yet. So to that extent, you know, I'm not a hardcore skeptic where, you know, none of this is possible. You know, there's a lot of things we don't know about the universe, a lot, you know, and so therefore I always pull back a little bit from being a hardcore skeptic, go, well, you know what? I'm just going to wait and see. Let's just see what happens. Mm. To me, it's the best argument for cryonic, for being chronically frozen. Come back 1,000 years from now and go, oh, that's the explanation for that. Oh, we thought that was so mysterious.
Yeah. I mean, we are drawing this together. It's a fascinating story to finish on there, Billy, the spooky radio set at Michael's wedding. But why for you, I mean, ultimately, is it because you just start at a different starting point that you are open to the idea of a spiritual realm? You obviously do believe in God, and therefore, I guess the barrier, the evidential kind of, you know, barrier is lower for you in terms of what counts for you as a potentially plausible explanation for what on the face of it are, like Michael says, extraordinarily mysterious things. And although I get the sense you're just as skeptical of Michael of 90% of the accounts, there is that 5 or 2% that just for you seem to require actually a supernatural sort of explanation, really.
Absolutely. And I think as Christians, we're called to truth, and truth means investigating and understanding and making sure that something is true before just saying, oh, that was a miracle, right? I mean, there are things that we will call miraculous that are, and there are things that, you know, I think might not be. We're just calling them that. But if we're going to stand on truth, I think it requires realizing that there are going to be times, in fact, it may be the majority of the time, that the natural explanation is what's going on. But for me, as somebody who, from a journalistic perspective, looks at the facts and the details, I think I'm a little different in that, you know, there's sort of a weight in my mind. And when that weight starts to become so heavy on one side with the details and the facts, I'm prone as a Christian to wanting to investigate it, but also to saying there may be something here. And I think God shows up in amazing ways sometimes, in unexpected ways. And I'm probably less comfortable saying I don't know, and I'm comfortable not knowing. I want to know. I believe that, you know, we were created, obviously. I believe this happened in a certain way. You know, we don't all get to have 50,000 different creation stories. We can have them, but one of them is true. And so for me, that is Christianity. I have found that to be true, and you know, I've found that to move from my head into my heart, and it definitely makes me more open to that possibility.
Yeah. Michael, any final thoughts as we close out today's show?
Be skeptical. Keep an open mind. Really, I mean, there's a lot of
people. I like that, actually.
So
we agree on that.
Okay,
we agree.
You know, take different paths, and
yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad there's a note of agreement, and I fully expected there to be some, at least, on today's show. Look, do go and get the books. Playing with Fire by Billy Hallowell. I'll make sure there's a link to Billy's website and to Michael's as well. His latest book, Giving the Devil His Due, but he's written many others as well that you might be interested in. Really simple, actually. Both their websites are just their name followed by .com. BillyHallowell.com, MichaelShermer.com. Billy and Michael, thanks for having such a fascinating conversation today.
You're welcome.
On the
show.
Thank
you.
Well, I look forward to hearing your thoughts on demons, exorcism and ghosts. Email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do check out the show page as well for all the links to the social media where you can get in touch as well. Some great stuff coming up that I want to tell you about, actually, for your diary. Some really interesting lectures and events and new podcasts that you may be interested in as well. Just to reiterate, though, as I did at the very beginning of today's show, it's been an interesting week, especially with the release of the full report on sexual misconduct by Ravi Zacharias. And anyone who has followed apologetics for any length of time, he has been until his death in May this last year, one of the preeminent figures in the world of apologetics. So the shocking reports of the double life he led, which have now been fully released, have really obviously hit hard, not just for the victims of his misconduct, but the many Christians who have looked up to him as a father figure, a trusted figure, have even, you know, come to faith through his ministry. So sobering lessons for anyone involved in Christian ministry. Again, news reports and response from us at Premier over at premierchristian.news. And I do plan to share a personal response on the whole situation in the coming week. So yeah, look out for that on the social media channels and this podcast and our YouTube channel as well. Before we get to some of your comments on transgender, just want to tell you that there's a really great series of free public lectures on Zoom coming up soon. It's called Questions of Our Time. It's hosted by the Christian Evidence Society, And it begins on the 23rd of February when former Cabinet Minister Jonathan Aitken will be discussing the question, in a world of fake news, who can we trust? And there's a load of other really interesting contributors to this lecture series. Concludes on the 23rd of March with crossbench peer, former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rome Williams, addressing prayer and spirituality under the title, Is God Really Listening? The host of each evening will be Nigel Barve, who's the vice chair of the Christian Evidence Society and former editor of the Salvation Army magazine, The War Cry. And they're absolutely free to attend. You just need to register at christianevidence.org. That's christianevidence.org for those five Tuesday night lectures happening from February the 23rd. By the way, if you enjoyed today's show on demons as exorcism, can I encourage you to check out Cameron Bertuzzi's recent interview with Father Vince Lampert? He's a Catholic exorcist. Really interesting conversation with him. That's available on Cameron's Capturing Christianity podcast, or indeed his video channel on YouTube. Let's go to some of your responses to recent editions of the show. First of all, just some general lovely emails that have come in. This one from MJ says, I'm a long-time listener from South Africa. I travel a lot for work, but I'm usually not alone in the car and spend a lot of time with you and your guests while I drive. Some of my favourite co-travellers have been John Lennox and N.T. Wright. The way they present the gospel and apologetics with such patience and kindness challenges me to be less confrontational and a more gracious and patient person. I've been listening for about 3 years and I've worked my way through most of your back catalogue. I've been inspired and challenged by the show, at times doubting everything only to find myself with a stronger faith than ever. Your show's prompted me to systematically work through what I believe by writing it all down and really evaluating it bit by bit. I'm looking for an online apologetics course to do as well, so if you have any recommendations, please do share. Thank you very much, MJ. Lovely to hear from you from South Africa. There are lots of good apologetics courses out there if you go looking. We are hoping to release our own apologetics sort of curriculum as well from Unbelievable, based on the archive we have of Unbelievable Conference teaching. So look out for that. We're hoping to be able to make that available from around the time of our Unbelievable Conference. And that is not far away. I'm pleased to tell you that we have a date, Saturday, the 15th of May. Make sure to ring fence that. It is going to be an online conference. Obviously, the COVID rules, we're not expecting to be relaxed in any way that would allow an in-person gathering. But we are hoping to see many, many people from all over the world for our Unbelievable Conference on Saturday, the 15th of May. We have some really fantastic speakers, but I'm going to release more details in the next couple of weeks. And we hope to open up the ticketing before the end of February. So look out for that. But yeah, really excited about that. And the fact that we hope to be able to, for the first time, make an Unbelievable Apologetics course available as part of that. Thanks also to John Higgins on Instagram. Got in touch about his The Bible Is Art channel. He runs that on YouTube. It makes videos on the literary art of the Bible, as well as a series of videos on A Christian Guide to Beauty and Design. He said, I'd love you to check it out. I did. I was really impressed by it, John. So thank you very much. And if you're interested in that, The Bible Is Art on YouTube is what you're looking for. Let's go to your thoughts on the transgender debate from last week. Gosh, what a lot of interesting response we've had to that. Some of it's quite short and sweet. Ben in Rochester Hills, Michigan, one of the best discussions I've heard on this topic. Both speakers were sensible, reasoned well with each other, and avoided posturing. And of course, you did an excellent job moderating. Thank you, Ben. So this was the Reverend Christina Beardsley and Preston Sprinkle who were in conversation on last week's show. Preston's new book, Embodied, was the reason we really held this. And he, taking a more traditional approach in terms of Christian sexuality, but very much a grace-filled one to those who experience transgender feelings. And Christina, obviously very pro the trans cause as a transgender vicar in the Church of England. Now, there were some pretty robust responses among the feedback that came in. People like Peter, who said, I was disgusted that the priest was allowed to spout the transgender agenda. I am a ex-transgender myself. You cannot change or water down the Bible, which this priest is doing. And why is Christina still allowed to be in the C of E? Okay, thank you very much, Peter. And Bill said, I love your show, including the podcast I'm writing about, but I want to make a comment on the transgender priest, Christina. I don't know a gentle way to put this, but that person is a disturbed individual talking total nonsense. Though I don't have a problem with you interviewing her, quite the contrary, I'm very disappointed that the Church of England would have such a person hiding behind a clerical shirt and collar. Only Satan tells people to sexually mutilate themselves like the priests of Magna Mater or whoever it was and poison their bodies with dangerous drugs. I'm not criticizing this person so much as the enablers who encourage her, and to think that it is the Church of England is very sad. So that was sort of at one end of the spectrum, the response that was received. But none of the others were of a more arguably measured nature, though very few actually coming out in total agreement with Christina's perspective. So here's Joel, who says, thanks for the fruitful discussion that you facilitate week after week. First time emailer, but long time listener. I thought the transgender conversation was dealt with extremely sensitively. Both Preston and Christina showed clear love and respect for one another. Ultimately, it seems as though Christina and Preston have a disagreement about the relationship of truth to the individual. Preston's view weighted more towards truth outside of and imposed on the person, while Christina emphasizes personal truth, which emerges from the person. Having said that, I doubt that Preston disregards internal justifications for beliefs, as I doubt Christina denies external justifications. Anyway, I would like to pick on something that Christina said, which I suspect will be missed by most people, as indeed it was by Preston and yourself. About halfway through the podcast, Christina stated that a transgender person is one who experiences incongruity between body and mind, and that cisgendered people don't have that. While it's true that cisgender people don't experience gender sex incongruity in the same way as transgender people do, it's clumsy at best to suggest that they don't experience incongruity between body and mind. What about body dysmorphia and anorexia? Many people who experience body dysmorphia or anorexia literally perceive their bodies as vastly divergent from the external reality. How about dissociative disorders? I myself have experienced a number of dissociative episodes and even persistent feelings of disconnection between mind, body and self. I've floated outside of my body and have believed my body is not my own. I've been convinced that I'm not even a real person. Such delusions took me down some very dark paths. But we rightly treat these conditions as ailments of the mind and treat them accordingly. Considering this, I cannot understand the hypersensitive response so many people have when someone dares suggest that transgender might also be best treated in the same way. Perhaps conforming the body to the mind is simply the path of least resistance in the case of transgender, or maybe simply a more actionable and practical than endorsing beliefs about floating outside oneself, etc. There also seems to be the tacit assumption that a cisgendered person couldn't possibly understand the experience of a trans person. This is taken for granted in our culture and helps explain the omission of conditions such as body dysmorphia and disassociation in these conversations. The current cultural discourse around identity and self seems to suggest that certain people stand no chance of understanding certain other people. I reject this as a matter of hope and imago Dei. After all, I've known people understand me, even when there seems to be no experiential basis for their understanding. Blessings to you, the team, and your family. Thank you, Joel. Appreciated that really interesting email from you. Tim in Saskatoon says, thanks for being willing to tackle this discussion. As a conservative Christian, I fall into the historical categories regarding sex and gender, but always try to understand why someone I disagree with thinks differently. I noticed a moment where a roadblock I've often encountered when speaking with transgender advocates became visible during the discussion when Sprinkle asked for a definition of gender. There was a bit of back and forth and didn't really clarify the position, but revealed there are different definitions being used by both parties. Similarly, in discussions I've had, there has been a terribly difficult time for any transgender advocate to be able to define what a man or woman is. Yet isn't that the whole foundation upon which their worldview stands? For example, if someone born a man can later identify as a woman and claim that trans women are women, doesn't it presume that the term woman has a concrete definition? We're told biology has nothing to do with it, and Caitlyn Jenner is just as much a woman as the Queen. We're told that a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman, but this has the term defining itself and is meaningless. One can't even say there's a spectrum of gender because a spectrum has identifiable standards wherein relationships can be made respective of those standards. It's all very confusing when there's an entire movement that promotes the identity of something that is undefinable, especially in light of the LGB of the sexual revolution, as they hold to a very strict standard of male and female, which would put them in direct opposition to the T category. I wish that issue could have been fleshed out. Perhaps it may be in a future episode. Thank you very much, Tim in Saskatoon. Going to leave this one anonymous, but very interesting sort of perspective coming in here. Long-time listener of Unbelievable, found it to be such a blessing, has helped me to widen my understanding of theology and strengthen my faith. Thank you. Thank you very much. I was particularly keen to listen to Christina Beardsley and Preston Sprinkle. I wasn't disappointed. It was frank and honest, and I agreed and disagreed with many of the comments both participants made. I don't claim to be an expert in this or understand all the terminology, but there was a part of the conversation I feel wasn't touched upon but needs consideration. I am one of only two Christians in my extended family, and the other family member is a teenage girl who is identifying as a boy but hasn't yet begun hormone therapy or any other transgender-related medical intervention. My family member was a troubled 15-year-old girl when she came out as being gay. We were all shocked as a family as she'd shown no signs of being attracted to girls at that point in her life. She'd had boyfriends and was a girly girl growing up. We have a couple of gay men in our family, so we had a bit of experience of family members coming out. In the case with both men, they both had gay cliche characteristics that they both fit. That meant no one was shocked when they came out. In the case of the female relative, there was a history of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse in the family affecting this girl and all of her siblings, and a family history of suffering with poor and debilitating mental health. After a short time, my cousin came out saying that she was in fact not only gay, but also identified as being a boy. She says she has felt like this since she was young and has shared memories with family members of how she showed male tendencies when she was growing up. However, close family members believe these memories to be skewed. They're not how we remember them. She also admitted to having body dysmorphia and body dysphoria. When she came out as identifying as a boy, she was already receiving support from child and adolescent mental health services, and she was signposted to a transgender support group. She was also given some transgender-specific counselling and offered housing in an LGBT-assisted home where she lived as a lodger with someone trained to support LGBT teenagers. Her Catholic school was also very supportive and agreed to use the male name that my cousin chose and later changed her name to. Changes to using unisex bathroom and changing areas at school also helped. I'm really happy that there was so much support available for my cousin during this life-changing transition. She went from feeling adrift in no man's land to receiving so much support and attention, she was enveloped in an acceptance she had never experienced before. 4 years on, my cousin is in a same-sex relationship with another young adult who is also a girl identifying as a boy, but is further along in the transition process. The thing I find concerning is that it seemed that as soon as my cousin started using the terms associated with being transgender, all of her support was immediately focused around this specifically. However, I worry that a teenager who was already considered to be vulnerable and with a history of abuse and poor mental health was almost persuaded to go down the transgender route before being given the opportunity to explore ways of improving current mental and physical health issues. Christina mentioned during her discussion with Preston on more than one occasion that a person isn't forced to become transgender, and I agree, they are not intentionally. I wonder, though, if it is possible that someone has been forced into becoming transgender almost by accident. My cousin went from being a child struggling to gain attention in a home with parents and siblings dealing with their own demons to almost overnight inheriting a whole new group of friends and family, all with a common cause that united them and forged close bonds and acceptance, almost forming an elite group where it's good to stand out for being different and individual, even though there seems to be a uniform in dressing and looking the same. My cousin started radically shaving and colouring her hair and getting numerous piercings and tattoos, which is not unusual for teenagers, but if you look at her transgender peers, they are all sporting a very similar style. Now, the word transgender has been thrown around, although I'm not sure this is the case here. I feel that would belittle my cousin's feelings about herself and her identity. Although I do believe that in a millennial generation where youngsters' badges of honour are how many diagnoses they have or how many different types of counselling they're receiving, I don't think transgender is too far a stretch to believe. My cousin has a strong faith that has never wavered during these years of change. However, she is too worried about the response she may receive to go to church alone. None of her friends are Christians, and I live too far away to offer in-person support. She believes, as I do, if we're all made in God's image, and God loves us all unconditionally, that God would never disown her or punish her for being true to herself. My fear is that she hasn't fully dealt with the mental health issues that were being investigated before she began her transgender journey, and the support services are so terrified of being accused of being politically incorrect in not providing support that they've actually encouraged her to become transgender rather than encouraging her to holistically explore her personal and mental health issues. Thanks for providing a safe place where these necessary conversations can happen. Thank you very much. I did appreciate that email. Obviously, a very specific story and relationship you have going on there. But all the very best as you seek to wisely engage with and pastor that cousin in your life. Okay, that's probably all we've time for on the show today. But there was a lot of interesting feedback to that transgender show. You're welcome to send your thoughts in as well on that. And indeed today's topic, demons and exorcism. Perhaps you've got a personal story you'd like to share on that front. Be very interested to hear it. Always interesting when you get not just opinions, but personal experience with these emails that we love reading out at the end of each show. For now, thank you very much for being with me on today's show. Do hope you enjoy podcasts from Premier. It's not just Unbelievable, you know, we've got some really great new ones that have just come out. A new John Stott podcast, which you can find, Mucky Business with Tim Farron. And glad to say that the Ask NT Write Anything podcast will be going weekly from next week. So look out for that. And that's only possible because of the support we've had from generous listeners. So thank you very much if you are able to support Unbelievable and our ministry. It's great to know that you can do that. You can find out more at the show page as ever, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And let me tell you what's coming up same time next week. Such an interesting conversation for you next week. Diverting from the usual dialogue format of the show to just a one-to-one interview next week with Richmond Wandera. He's a Ugandan pastor and Unbelievable listener. An amazing story of coming from the slums of Kampala through theological education, now overseeing a network of church leaders in East Africa. And we're having a really frank conversation about Christianity in Africa, the good, the bad, witchcraft, the prosperity gospel, things like that. And he's got some fascinating perspectives on that. You heard me mention him a little earlier on in the program, in the discussion between Michael and Billy. So look out for that interview same time next week. For now, thanks for being with me. See you then.